Thank you very much. I just, I'd like to say I'm very happy to be on this panel. And as a research library, one of the largest research libraries in the world, what I'll hopefully do is kind of set out our view on orphan works as well as kind of explain the context within which that sits. It's quite ironic, I think, that often it's libraries that in these events seek to represent the interests of academics and researchers. This is because I think the researchers, the cleverest people on the planet, find copyright law too intimidating, and they leave it to their librarians. There is a moral in there somewhere, I'm sure. Again, I think education is often the silent witness in these debates. And so I'm extremely glad that WIPO has put this panel and this session together. When we think about knowledge and intellectual property at the British Library, we very much see that what we have done through copyright law is really create knowledge as a commodity. We heard the word commodity many, many times yesterday. And this really obscures the essential nature of knowledge, which is a public good, and that this public good is best disseminated widely and freely. And this is really somewhat different to the latest Britney Spears CD, that, you know, there wouldn't be much business behind the music industries that invest in Britney Spears if the CDs were, or the downloads were, distributed very freely and very widely. But this is what we really need, I think, with knowledge. So we have this sort of, in the way that Lessig talked about yesterday, a different ecology. And I think what we need to do is think through the way that we really approach copyright from a policy perspective. Clearly, when we think about around copyright law, we need to think about it as a tool for industry and economy, but it is also a tool for the citizen. It is also has an impact upon authors, it has an impact upon education, and it has an impact upon culture. And I would urge policymakers that when they're developing copyright law, including the intellectual property, the World Intellectual Property Organization, to think through these five categories always. So industry, citizen, author, education, and culture. What we've heard from the previous panel is that by imposing unnecessary restrictions on the use of existing knowledge, which we do in patents and copyright law, what we're doing is actually increasing the time and the cost of producing knowledge. And my question is, and this is the development agenda question, you know, in a world of poverty, disease, global warming, can we really, really afford to have these barriers? And is it appropriate that the same rules apply to access to knowledge as distribution of a Britney Spears CD? I think, you know, that is hopefully something we will discuss in the question. So, okay, moving on to orphan works. Often where the industrial ecology meets the education ecology, we get a bit of a car crash. And I think orphan works is one of these areas. So we know about orphan works. It's become quite controversial in the context of the Google settlement. That primarily was around the digitization of books. As a research library, we are less interested in books. The mad people that we heard about from Northern Patagonia do not fly to the British Library to access the latest J.K. Rowling. They come for rare and unique material. So actually that is what we are interested in digitizing. So we have digitized, for example, historical letters, grey literature, posters, oral histories, also newspapers and historical newspapers. So what I will talk about is, you know, some of this rare material, and I think this is where some of the disconnect between the industrial ecology and the educational ecology really, really sits. Two, there are such things as orphan works. There are many studies. For example, one of our 2000... days' worth of sound recordings. These include interviews with jazz musicians from the UK in the 1980s. We did those recordings ourselves. 20 years later, we couldn't find about a third of the people that we'd interviewed. There is an American study on books going back to the 1930s, so books up to 90 years old. 31% of the books were orphan works. This doesn't surprise me. I was a publisher. I don't think there are that many publishing houses that have files of agreements going back 90 years. Similarly, collecting societies are a product of the photocopying machine. The data that sits within collecting societies really dates back to the 1980s. So the further you go back in history, the more orphan works you see. The Association Cinémathèque Européenne, they estimate that 21% of what sits in European cinema archives are orphan works, and 60% of those are over 60 years old. So there are many cases and studies that orphan works do exist. The third phenomenon I called the YouTube phenomenon. We work very, very well with the UK Music Collecting Society. When we kind of roll up, they look at us and think, "Oh God, it's the British Library again. They're wanting to clear rights in 1930s English bagpipe recordings with harmonies in Manx and Cornish." Right, we'll get out our collecting tins and rattle. They've got a nice blingy building in a nice part of London. We'll be able to get some money out of this. So we sit down and say, right, we'd like to clear 2,000 days' worth of sound recordings, please. And they sort of look a bit nervous, and then they think, oh, no, we can do this. Google, BBC, we've got good relations. We've done this. That's mass clearance of rights. We can do this. So they say, well, who are the publishers? And we say, oh, publishers aren't the problem. We've actually cleared 30% of the 2,000 days' worth already with the publishers themselves. We're here because the remaining 70% is unpublished. So they again look a bit nervous and say, right, okay, so who is it that's singing? And we say, well, we don't know because this is unpublished. It doesn't come with a little jacket telling you who's singing. But we do know that around day 1,300 that there's someone in a free-form jazz compilation singing and also playing something that sounds a bit like Sweet Georgia Brown, but we don't really know. They're not about to sit down and kind of listen to 2,000 days' worth of unrecorded sound recordings. So, you know, this is a real kind of car crash between, hello, I would like to clear the Queen is Dead by Morrissey, and the type of material that educational institutions want to put up. So, you know, we're not always talking about clear, commercially produced material with lots of metadata, so we know exactly what it is. So again, the intellectual property regime, which really is constructed around well-known creators and their material being sold, doesn't really kind of work very well in this context. There are, of course, ethical and social aspects to this material as well. We have curators, we have very good relationships with communities that produce ethnographic recordings, for example, or we have a huge program of oral histories. One of the collections that's up on our website is interviews with survivors of the Holocaust. They're really not very interested, and the issues are not copyright in nature. They are ethical, it's moral rights, cultural sensitivities. So even if copyright law tells us that this is okay, we can clear it, we're actually, from a reputational perspective and a relationship perspective, because we need good we need good relations with these communities to build our collections. So we need a system which is not necessarily about the black and white of copyright law, but something that gives us reputational certainty. And I think in this instance, as Lawrence Lessig kind of pointed out yesterday, outside of the industrial ecology, if you start putting money into other ecologies that you can really start to distort and corrupt existing relationships. So those are sort of some points around the type of stuff and the issues that we see. I think I've got some minutes left. I have some solutions. Very quickly. There are three solutions. One is a pure exception. In America, they proposed a pure exception. So essentially, if you do a diligent search and the rights holder pops up, that statutory damages will not payable. You will just retrospectively have to pay for that usage. The advantage of that is it facilitates mass digitization because the costs of search are very, very expensive. The downside is that's probably not scalable. It makes sense for a few items, but not many. Extended collective licensing. This is good because it does give legal certainty. However, it assumes that everything is kind of commercial in nature or should be commercial in nature. And in a world of disintermediation, to what extent the photographers or authors or even performing artists want to be represented by collecting society is, I think, something in the UK that we're really starting to struggle with. And then finally, a governmental license, which we see in Japan, Canada, and Hungary. I think this is a very good solution for the types of material that are not commercial in nature. However, from a collecting society and a rights holder perspective for commercial material, I think that probably poses a number of issues. So I think the solution is actually not one single solution. I would, and this is nearly what we had in the UK, I would propose that those three systems can actually all sit against and alongside each other, and depending upon the work, you would choose one of those three solutions. Thank you.